My experiences as a classroom teacher, it's probably been quite generous to say 20 years, it's probably closer to 30. Public education, I'm a Sydney girl. And can I ask who's a teacher out here? Oh, lots of you. Great job, isn't it? How many of you teach this age group? Okay, keep your hands up if you also parent this age group. Anyone out there who is, you know, obviously you're from a variety of fields and professions, and there'd be parents as well as professionals here. We're all fairly experienced with this age group. What happens to them? If you can explain that to me, I'd really appreciate how. Now, you're going to have to be really honest with me here. Stop, pull me up when I'm wrong, but this is the age group that come trippingly down the stairs every morning with a big smile on their face, always on time, their beds are made, their rooms are clean, their homework's been done a week earlier than it needed to be, and they come down ready for breakfast. G'day mum, g'day dad, how's your day? Can't wait to get to school. Or is that, you know, the Jerry Seinfeld bizarro world? I think we sort of appreciate that that's actually not what we have. And I challenge anyone who parents this age group to not take a little moment of reflection and think, you remember that one night of passion and we thought it'd be a really good idea to start a family? Did we think about that? Look at what we've got here. We've gone from this gorgeous little creature to something that crawls out of the bedroom in the morning. Looks like they've gone out backwards through the spin cycle, and we get a grunt, or we might get a bit of a snarl, and that's about it. And we think, what's happened? Now, if you teach that age group, and the majority of my years in teaching was teaching that year 5-6. Now, I'll tell you a little story, and you see if those teachers out there that teach that age group and beyond, see if this rings a bell, because this is when the shoe starts to fall off. This middle years age group, 10 to 15, year 5 through to year 9, massive, massive changes during this period of time. Now, I'll give you a little story which demonstrates what I see, or what I used to see. I was continuing to teach. I've been doing this kind of work now for about 8 years, and only this work for the last 4 years. So I was combining it still with teaching. So it's about 4 years since I was in a classroom. But my last 2 years on permanent teaching, I had an opportunity class, year 5, year 6, really talented children, you know, ready to be rocket scientists and find the cure for cancer. And parents who'd already found the cure for cancer and wanted their children to pick up on, you know, let's be part two of that journey. So very, you know, quite demanding parents, very driven, very, you know, good egos, no worries, but, not, you know, between here and here, common sense, not a lot. So at the start of a typical year 6 year, everyone wants a job. I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it. Pick up papers, yeah, I'll do it. Take the notes to the office, I'll do it. Everyone wants a job because this is that age group where they're starting to want some responsibility, some independence. You know, I'm kingpin now, I'm in year 6, I want to do it. So you allocate jobs. I had one group of girls who were particularly technically minded, so they wanted to be the computer monitors. So I set the task for the girls, great. Now we had, as those who work in public education know that, you know, you've got to wait till something blows up before it's replaced. So we had several computers along the back desk that were, you know, they were a little bit less than in good repair, and they had to be turned off every night, otherwise we wouldn't have computers. So the girls' task was to turn the computers off every night to make sure we had a working computer next day. So religiously, they would make sure that they got it done. Occasionally they might forget and say, girls, you forgot to do your job. Oh, sorry. I'll fix it. We'll go and do it now. Now, by about halfway through term 3, I started to notice a little bit of an attitude change. There were three mornings in a row when I went into the classroom, and the computers, at least one of them, was not turned off. So I, you know, very gently pulled the girls aside and said, girls, the computers were left on again. That's three nights in a row last night. Now, keeping in mind their response in term 1, oh, sorry. This was the response by term 3. And I thought, there you have it, there you go. Meanwhile, I had a little group of horticultural boys who wanted to tend our little veggie patch herb garden. Now, the little veggie patch herb garden was out the back of the classroom. So at assembly time, they'd come in through the front door. So they actually had to remember to do their job at the back. Now, I didn't often go out to check, but occasionally I would, and I'd see that they were flourishing. They looked pretty good. The herbs were in pretty good condition. Now, halfway through term three, I thought, I haven't been out to see how our little garden's going, so I better just have a bit of a check. Well, out the back was a Sonoran desert with a few twigs. So I said, boys, can you just come out the back with me? And, you know, glazed over, where are we going? Where's she taking us? Went out the back and said, boys, these used to be herbs. One of the boys, without shadow of a doubt, looked at me and said, who's Herb? So I thought, and so it begins. Now, by the end of year six, they're well and truly over it, well and truly ready to move on. Any primary school teachers here who teach this age group know that they're a bit over it. I'm bored. Why do I need to do this? This is not important. You know, you get the snarl, you get the head. Now, of course, I'm generalising. There are some gorgeous kids, and they all have their periods of being gorgeous. And when I was lining up to go into the ladies before I came here, I saw several students here. And I suddenly did a little bit of a panic and thought, you know what, they're going to be sitting in the audience thinking, this stupid old woman, what is she talking about? How long is it since she was that age? Why doesn't she remember what it was like? Yes, I do remember what it was like, and I was exactly the same. The difficulty is dealing with this age group. They are a wonderful age group, but there's some certain little strategies that we need to rethink. And unfortunately, when we get locked into our position of whether we're teaching, working with them, in whatever capacity, sometimes we lose sight of who they are and where they are. And as a teacher, we're so driven by curriculum and ticking boxes and having so many additional tasks that sometimes we lose sight of the little person in front of us. And today is all about perhaps rethinking some of the ways that we approach these kids to get the best out of them so that they're happy and we're happy. And if we can apply this to any, whether we're teaching them or whether we're parenting them or working with them in another capacity, sometimes it's good just to remind yourself, because oftentimes when I work with teachers, they say to me, I did know that, I'd just forgotten it. Because in the mix of everything else that we have to do, we tend to work on overdrive. So today is a little bit about, you know, just a little bit of a catch up and a reminder. So none of those examples there of what we see in our kids this age group would be a surprise to you. Friends are critically important. Now, any teenager will tell you that another 15-year-old knows more than you do. Whether you're parenting them or teaching them, you don't know what you're talking about. I'll ask someone else. And that's a fairly common. We don't need to be offended by that. That's very, very critical in this day and age and in this period of development. Friends are everything. When I work with year six students ready to go to primary school, ready to go to high school, and I say, what is it that you're most looking forward to about going to high school? And the first thing has been 100% strike rate, making new friends. What's the first thing you're, what's something that you're concerned about? Not making friends. So friends and peer groups are of critical importance. Now, there's a reason why some, you know, they're being impulsive, less attentive, a little bit of an attitude, all of those things that we talked about before. There are some reasons for that, and I'll briefly explain and refresh some of you. Obviously, those people out there who are psychologists and work in this field would know far more about this area than I do, so I break it down into the common, you know, garden variety, herb variety language so that I can understand it. A couple of points, though, is concentration span. Who teaches high school here? Okay, windows close after, you know, 10 minutes. Dr. Loretta Giorcelli's done a lot of work on this area on, you know, on middle years. She believes that adolescents have the concentration span of their age in years plus 3 minutes. So if you've got them for 45 minutes to an hour, good luck with that. I actually challenge that because I believe, and I'm sorry to the men out there, and there's a variety of you out there in the audience, but I believe that we've got a window of opportunity, girls, of about 10 words. 10 words and then the curtain's closed. So if we don't make it meaningful, we've lost them. Now, if we're actually teaching them, because, you know, males, the way the brain is, it's not a reflection on their lack of interest in what we're saying, it's that the linguistic skills, that part of the brain is not, you know, is at a different stage of development. So if we're teaching and we're the chalk and talk kind of teacher and we stand up there and we talk to these kids for 45 minutes and we just go blur, we wonder why we've lost them, you know, their age in years plus 3 minutes, we have to find another way to switch them on. We have to work hard at that. And we're going to be looking at some ways to do that. So modelling adults, you'll see that I've referred to modelling adults there. While our young people might appear that what we have to say and what we think and what we do are of very little importance to them, they actually are still watching. They are watching and they are taking it in. And I know a perfect example. I have two sons, one 24 and one 25. And, you know, they still do it, and I've only just one, so I mustn't have done too badly, because we downsized about 6 months ago. Both boys are still living at home. We downsized about 6 months ago, and the oldest one was sick of living in the cupboard, so he moved out 3 months ago. So, you know, obviously haven't done too much damage, but we did have our issues. We've had our ups and downs, as any families do, but we've just got, you know, one out and one still to go. He's quite comfortable living at home, thanks very much, so... You know, we're not doing too badly, but they do model you. So I would find that I would say something. I'd plant a seed of information, or if they did ask my opinion on an 18th birthday party or a 17th birthday party, and I'd give all the reasons why I didn't think they should go. No parents, no supervision, there's a mixture of legal age drinking and underage drinking, and, you know, you get the eye roll and the, oh, don't you trust me, Mum? Don't you think I'm going to do the right thing? So then the guilt trip, you know, all of that kind of stuff, and then you shuffle off to your bedroom and think, oh, gee, did I handle that badly? And then a week before the party, I'm not going to the party. Oh, why are you not going to the party? Oh, well, because my friend Luke said that there's going to be a mixture of kids drinking. Oh, we know that. One example of modelling, which I was... You know, I was lucky that I was only at the beginning of eating my lamb shanks and not at the end, because I probably would have tossed the bone. I was out having dinner with my husband, and there were a family of three. And teenage daughter, about 16, mum, dad. And I glanced across and thought, oh, isn't that cute? So, you know, I'm tucking into my lamb shanks, and then I looked back and they'd given their order. The waiter came over, took their order. As soon as the waiter left, out came the phones, all three of them. Sitting there doing this. Now, I don't know who pulled the phone out first. I thought, what happened to a family dinner? So if mum or dad pulled the phone out first, well, obviously, teenager's going to do that. And if teenager pulled the phone out first, it probably would have been a good idea for mum or dad to say, it's a family dinner, can we do without that for now? So modelling is really critical. Brain development. Very, very briefly, I'm going to put this, you know, in a way that, this is a way that I can understand it, and I can thank Andrew Fuller for clarifying this, because he speaks the common man language, and that's the language that I understand. At the age of around about 10 or 11, the brain suddenly starts to undergo some massive changes. The adolescent brain is very plastic, it's very malleable, and there's a lot going on, and there's more and more research coming out constantly. Basically, three things start to happen, which explains a lot of this behaviour. In the brain, by the age of around about 10, there's literally trillions of synapses or connections which join the connections between brain cells. Now, the brain makes an executive decision, okay, use it or lose it. Whatever connections you're not using, they're going to be pruned back. So there's a process of synaptic pruning that starts to occur. Once those synapses are pruned, if they're not activated and not used, once they're pruned, they don't regrow. So once they're gone for good. And where that happens initially is in the frontal lobe of the brain. And the frontal lobe of the brain is the part of the brain that's responsible for understanding consequences, for planning, and for impulse control, regulating, you know, the urge to just do instead of thinking about it. The second process that starts to happen is that the brain cells and nerve cells in the brain, the ones that are being activated, are coated by a myelin sheathing. It's a protected coating. But what that does, while it sort of protects those pathways, it also supercharges the brain. So not only are they making dopey impulsive decisions, but they're making them faster. So it's, you know, increasingly difficult to keep up. If we say to a, typically, a 14-year-old boy, and I'll explain why I use the example of a boy, I'm not picking on you, but if you say to a 14-year-old boy, what were you thinking? What do you think their response is generally?
I don't know.
And they actually don't know. They're not saying it to tick you off, because tick that box, they've already done that. They really don't know. They didn't think it through. Impulse, oh, let's do that. Oh, geez, that's probably not a good idea. Too late, done it. Now, if you ask them about the thought process, and Professor Atwood was talking about that earlier, about the thought process, they can't actually explain. And you don't have to have Asperger's to not explain. This is just a common teenage problem. Now, the reason that you're more likely to get that increased risk-taking behaviour and impulsive behaviour from boys rather than girls is that the adolescent brain also relies very heavily on the amygdala, which sits in the temporal lobe of the brain. Now, the amygdala is responsible for memory storage, for emotion regulation, so controlling emotions, but also for decision-making, making sensible decisions. So when you combine what's happening in the temporal lobe with what's happening in the frontal lobe, and there's all kinds of challenging issues and behaviours, then you can see why half the time they don't know where they're at. So we're a mile behind trying to keep up. The critical message here is that if you parent, teach or work with this age group, if you say to them, when they constantly make these impulsive decisions and they can't explain why, if you say to them, well, you know what, I've told you once, I've told you twice, how many times do I have to tell you, I guess you'll learn the hard way. The difficulty is that they do learn the hard way, but they'll learn the wrong way. And once those connections are pruned, they do not regrow. So potentially what we have by, you know, fully developed brain, 25, 26 for males, 23, 24 for females, we have an adult who really doesn't care. So it's really, really important that we have our structures, we have our expectations, and we have our boundaries in place. It's very easy to tell a 10-year-old what to do and expect generally most of the time that they'll do it, but we can expect that we'll probably get some kind of a bit of a lip back from maybe a 14 or a 15-year-old, but we need to persist. It's really critical. If we don't keep these pathways active and we don't keep these connections active and they're pruned back, they're gone for good. So this particular age group, we need to recognise that they're neither children nor adults, they're somewhere in between. There are different levels of development, there's obviously different needs, and we have to think about how we advise and how we respond to these young people. One of the critical strategies that we can use to help us deal with this age group in a more effective way is our communication strategies. Now, we're familiar with active listening and eye messages. For those of you who aren't, put your hand up in all honesty, and I'll put my hand up here quite happily. I know I've done it more than once, whether I've been teaching or parenting. You say, my house, my rules, my class, my rules, because I said so. I can see some are sort of saying, yeah, it's me, but I'm going to wait till somebody else puts their hand right up before I do. We all tend to do that. That's probably not the best option. That's when you get the hair toss, the eye roll, the grumble, the walk away. This is an age group where we need to start talking less and listening more. I was reading an article not that long ago that said four critical reasons why, and they isolated teachers and parents, don't listen well enough to this age group. Priorities, generally we've got other priorities. We want to get onto, what's your problem, I'll sort it out. Our ego tells us that we're more experienced, more worldly wise, we're more knowledgeable, so I know what your answer is before you get to the bottom line. And we're time poor. So when you combine all of those three things, we join the dots. Anyone here find themselves joining the dots with this? They get halfway through a story, when they do talk to you, get halfway through a story and you're busy, you're ready to move on, say, yeah, I get what you mean. And then you make an assumption on what they're telling you, and then a week later, you repeat what you think you heard, and they say, I didn't say that, you never listen. We need to start an active communication. And active doesn't mean we talk more, because they don't want that. They don't want to hear any more from us. If there's an opportunity to open up a conversation at the right time, we actively listen. And by actively listening is that we let them, for however long it takes, We don't ask them to, yeah, just get to the end of the story and then we'll sort it out. Then I'll solve your problem. We need to let them speak completely and then we confirm what we think we've said. So what you're telling me is such and such. So what I'm hearing is such and such. Make sure that we understand what they're saying. The other reverse message, and this comes from a Thomas Gordon model of communication, and he's got several models, one for parents, one for teachers, one for businesses, but the I message features very strongly in all of them. And the I message is a way of communicating what we think about what somebody else has said or done without putting them on the defensive. What's the first thing that will put a teenager offside is if you say to them, "You didn't. You didn't clean your room. You haven't finished your assignment. You're late for work." The minute we say it, we start off with "you," they're immediately taking that as, "I've done something wrong, here we go again, here's the nag," and their backs are against the wall, and we're asking for a fight. So an I message, it swings it around the other way. So a typical example would be if you've got a child who's made an agreement with you that they'll clean their room on a Saturday and the room's not clean, we don't say to them, "You haven't cleaned your room, you're not going to soccer until you've cleaned your room." We say, "I thought we had an agreement Saturday was room cleaning day." Or, "I'm disappointed that yet again your room's not clean." This doesn't mean rolling over. This doesn't mean giving in. Negotiating is not playing Fido and lying down and say, "Okay, you win," or putting up the white flag. Negotiating and I messages are all about asserting your response to their activity or their messages that they're giving you, but giving them the message in a different way so that you're not putting them on the defensive. You will be far better off getting a response and a conversation if you use that approach rather than the "you didn't," or "you said," or "you should have." So, Dr. David Smith, so looking at how we can actually switch this age group on. It's quite concerning when all the research, and it's still continuing, it doesn't matter whether it's in 2008 or 2015, the research is continually suggesting that we are losing a lot of our kids in schools by 15. They are increasingly disengaged in high school. They want to move on, move out, and Professor Atwood referred to that earlier in his talk, where they just don't see it as relevant. You know, why am I doing this? Why am I doing the Pythagoras theory? I'm never going to use it again. He was asked by the New South Wales Department of Education to review all the middle years literature with a view to establishing a platform of middle years strategies and middle years teaching and learning in schools. He came up with what I call the five R's, five really important principles for how we can actually get to this age group and switch on so that they get the most out of us and we get the most out of them. Okay, the first one's relationships. Where do I fit? As I said before, friendships are really, really critical. As teachers, as psychologists, as school counsellors, as parents, they don't want you to be their friend. The parent who believes that they want to be their child's best friend is making a big mistake. They are at the stage where they want to be responsible, independent, they are forming their own identity. They don't want to be an annex of you. So we have to give them some breathing space, but there needs to be a relationship. The relationship in this age group, if you ask any high school teacher about the teachers that they like the best, and they like the ones that give them some space, give them some responsibility, and give them a chance, and are not telling them what to do all the time. That they're consistent, firm, fair boundaries. You treat one behaviour that way and that group suffers the consequences, but that group over there, because they're always good and they've just stuffed up this once, we'll let them off the hook. They don't like that. So the relationship is built on trust and on fairness and consistency and firmness. They are looking for boundaries. They won't tell you that, but they really still are. So it's where do they fit? Relevance. This is an age group where it's, you know, what's in it for me? You teach year 3, 4, and you say, "Okay, get your science books out." They're out. "What are you going to tell me?" "Okay, I'm here. Give it to me." You ask a year 9 science class, "Okay, we're going to do such and such." Oh, it's boring. High school teachers, is that right? Boring. When am I ever going to need to know this? So we have to put it into a context that is relevant and a context that means something to them, that brings it into their world. So if they're doing an assignment on a subject that they have no interest in, We need to say, okay, forget about the content, forget about the subject matter. Look at the skill of the assignment. You're learning to plan, prioritise, chunk work. You're looking to put a task together that's going to be ready to hand in on a particular due date. That's what any employer will expect when you get a job. If an employer gives you a job to do, are you going to just look at it and say, I don't know where to start? What you're doing now in these assignments provides you with that skill. That's a life skill. You put it in that context, it makes more sense. If you're teaching PDHPE and you talk about skin cancer and you say, okay, well, there's going to be 20% of the population will have experienced some form of skin cancer by the time they're 60. The kids are just going to say, well, 60, they probably should be dead by then anyway, because that's really old. So who cares? They're lucky they lasted that long. You need to say, instead of saying, you know, 20%, say, okay, that means we've got a class of 30 here, six students in this class, if you reach 60, six students in this class will have experienced skin cancer by the time they're 60. And you see the kids looking around and say, well, there's a redhead, that's the first one off the... So they put it into a real world context. Really important to make it relevant. Responsibility. We tend to, when our kids go from primary to secondary school, we tend to remove all the responsibility and leadership that they had in primary school. They hate that. I haven't got a silver bullet for that. I don't know how we deal with that in high school, when obviously the year 12 are our student leaders. But they're looking to lead and to take more responsibility. We need to find opportunities for them to do that. By giving them more responsibility, we are increasing their chances of being resilient. Problem solving. Don't do for them all the time. Let them problem solve. Research recently, problem solving releases dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter, and it's a feel good. They feel great when they've solved something on their own. So we need to start thinking about how we can create some opportunities for them to be more responsible for their learning. Encourage them to be critics of their own work before they hand it in. Not just wait till a piece of paper comes back and says 10 out of 20. Ask them to analyse what they've done before they hand it in. Give them more ownership for their learning and more responsibility. Dumbing work down to meet, you know, this level is not helping them. They need challenges. We need to be consistent. We need to be firm. We need to be fair, but we need to have our expectations here. If we expect little, we get little. If we expect more, we get more. So the whole dumbing down, which involves that gold star for everything approach. Now, my youngest son, who happens to be here today, so I'm going to embarrass him in front of 1,000 people. Sorry, Ben, I won't look your way. Year 12 came home and said, Mum, I'm getting an award. I said, oh, really? That's great, mate. And I'm thinking, was it drama? Is it computer skills? He said, Mum, I don't want to go. I said, why not? He said, Mum, it's for 100% attendance. He said, Mel, I went to school every day this year. Isn't that what I was supposed to do? Now, yeah, being the proud mum, I said, but it's an award, mate, that's good. Fail. Yeah, while we continue to do these things, we're not helping that rigour that our kids need. And finally, resilience. We talk a lot about resilience. Andrew Fuller's an expert on resilience. One of the critical things we need to think about in building a resilient adult. We need to give them opportunities to take safe risks, but we need to help them by scaffolding the tasks. We have those kids in our that we work with every single day who are woulda, shoulda, coulda. I could have made the soccer team if I'd have turned up for the trials. I should have done a better. I should have got a better result in that exam, but I didn't study. I would have made the debating team if I'd have done a little bit more practice at public speaking. They're the kids that muffle their chances of success based on fear of failure and fear of disappointing either a teacher, a friend, a parent, or just in general just looking dopey. So they muffle their chances. Those kids that just say, oh, I've failed before, why do I try? And have labelled themselves from primary to secondary school. The way to turn those kids around and to give them some measure of success is to scaffold the tasks, break tasks down, chunk them into small manageable bits, talk about small achievable goals. Anything that is a step forward should be acknowledged. Instead of saying you got 10 out of 20, what did everybody else get? Oh, everybody else got 15. Well, you need to work harder. And the next time they get 12 out of 20, what did everyone else get? They still got 15. Well, you're still not good enough. Recognise the effort. recognise the two-point improvement rather than looking at what they haven't done. And thank you for this morning. Thank you.